Joining me in the Catalyst studio today is Daniel Zepp, who's the president of St. Petersburg Catholic High School. Welcome, sir.
Thank you for having me.
So you've had an interesting path. You were a very successful athlete up until college at Boston College. You had an injury there that sort of ripped you out of one identity and forced you into another identity. And then the sort of observations that you had during that experience played a big part in your life. So can you kind of just walk us through that period of your life?
Sure. I'll say that what many people don't know about me was that I've been the same height since the seventh grade, so 6'3". So I was someone growing up that was always affirmed for my physical size and my physical ability. So being that height, which I currently stand at 6'3", being that height at seventh grade certainly placed a number of expectations on me to perform athletically. And that's really largely how all of my friend structures and my community were structured as I moved through an all-boys high school experience in Louisville, Kentucky. I was the star of the football team. I was very much entrenched in that athletic identity of who I was. I was affirmed by my friend groups, my parents, the external community, not necessarily about the student I was in the class or the person I was or the virtue that I held, but rather around how I performed consistently on the playing field. And so, as such, you know, I played into that because that was my validation structure. That was my sense of community. And that single-mindedness also was part of what allowed me to achieve success in that realm. Moving into a college and university environment where I achieved the ultimate goal of getting a scholarship for football for Boston College, I was then woven more deeply into that culture and became more saturated, particularly 6 weeks into freshman year when my red shirt was taken away and I had to play right away. So coming in after an injury to a player who was in front of me on the depth chart then forced me into that experience much more immediately in college. That became my life. While I had goals to go to the best school that football could get me into, here I was in the college and university life, very deeply immersing myself in football and then everything that came along with that. So all of the social culture, all of the prestige status, and all of the community-based, that sense of self became much more narrowed. And at the time, my sophomore year, you know, it was the worst thing I could have imagined at the time. I got a back injury that abruptly concluded my football career. It's something that over time I've come to see as a blessing in disguise, but was something that fragmented me and my identity and who I was, because that's, again, how my validation structure and community was formed as a young boy. So when those questions happened, I began to ask, who am I? Who am I absent playing football? And who am I called to be in this world? So a lot of those questions and that point of desolation in my life were very much inform, I think, the person I am today. And I think the person that, you know, I will become in the future as a father and in my continued work in education. The questions that I asked during that time were very much certainly around identity and then certainly in faith. You know, when I went through this period of darkness, there were a number of people that reached out to me. I had a roommate who started inviting me to Mass. Now, here I am at a Catholic high school right now, and people assume that I'm a cradle Catholic and that I've gone to church my whole life. That really wasn't the case. So I had an invitation from a roommate that said, come along with me. I also had an athletic chaplain that, you know, really cared for me, I think, during that period of questioning. And then I also got engaged with many different retreat and service experiences at the school, to a point where I decided to be confirmed actually in the Catholic faith at Boston College. So I chose that at a later age because it, for different reasons, that didn't happen earlier on as it would traditionally as a Catholic. So I was confirmed in the Catholic faith in college. And I said, hey, everything's great, right? Well, not so fast. One of the things I started recognizing my junior year of college in particular was that all my friend groups were particularly fragmented. So I had my football friends, I had friends that were in a community of faith. I had friends that were very much kind of my retreat and my service friends. And then I had like my hanging out friends and like the people that I did things socially with and that I partied with, for lack of a better term. And so I started recognizing, wow, I'm really caught between two different worlds. And as I started to reflect upon my football experience in relation to who I was becoming as both a man and as a person of faith, I started asking the questions, again, who am I as a man in this world? And who am I as a person of faith? And are those things in conflict? Are they intersecting? Are they fragmented? How are they integrated in myself? And at the time, as it made sense in perspective now, it makes sense to understand why those worlds were so vastly different. I was trying to figure out who I was and trying on different hats, as many of us do in young adulthood. And I was trying to figure out what true relationship was beyond this need for status and approval and set communities. You know, it was really the first time in my life that I actually had to make friends in such a sense, because all of that had been built through athletics and through football. And it was also the first time that I actually really asked God in prayer who I was and who I was being called to be. And so those particular questions at that time, funny enough, didn't go away. You know, I was in the business school at the time and finished with a degree in management. But as I started thinking about whether or not I should go straight to Wall Street and work in finance, as many of my colleagues did, I started asking the question, well, I've been so terrifically formed here at Boston College by mentors and people within the community. Could I be that for someone else? And so I had done some leadership experiences on some of the retreat and service, and I served as the president of the Student Athlete Advisory Committee as a senior at Boston College. So I had all these experiences that sort of formed that. And over a lunch 2 weeks before graduation, I had no job. I sat with a mentor of mine, and he said, well, why don't you come on board and work in the Office of First Year Experience at Boston College? And he said, why don't you also be a graduate assistant? Graduate school? I had never thought of graduate school before. Here I was just happy to be in college. And at 18 years old, I was going to the league. I wasn't thinking about graduate school. But through that experience, I really went through a process of elimination and said, what program should I be in? And one of the programs that I decided upon was a master's work in pastoral ministry, because I wanted to ask questions about my faith. And I wanted to really be formed in such a way that I would learn more deeply about that and then also be able to impact others. What was going on simultaneously was the work in first year experience, where I started learning about student development. I got my first job because I could balance a budget, not because I could work with a student. But as I gained that experience, I came to love some of the orientation and the retreat work and the formation work we were doing with students on a regular basis. Pulling students into my office and inviting them to lunch, having conversations about life, purpose, meaning. It started to not only form the students, but also inspire my own thinking. One of the interesting things I noticed that time was in working with boys and men during that time period, I started recognizing that I wasn't the only one, that at a particular point, maybe in high school or college growing up, that I wasn't the only one who really felt a tension between who I was as a man and who I was as a person of faith. That it was confusing, and that many others would wear masks from time to time in different environments and would struggle with really becoming an integrated self. And those questions continued not only through my master's program, where I did some master's work on masculinity with student athletes in particular and ways in which they're forming their faith, but as well after my master's program, I realized that the questions still needed to be asked. And there was something that was driving me personally to continue asking how boys and men are formed around masculinity and faith. And so the questions that I started to ask, again, as a 19-year-old, did not go away. And so I needed to ask the question, and I needed to do the dissertation and the PhD for that particular reason, was that not only did this question need to be asked personally, which many scholars talk about the fact that many of us do not research, but me-search, but also that this needed to be asked for the purposes of the students that I was working with who were struggling in this and who desperately needed conversation partners and mentors that could support them through some of this discernment that they were having. So I sought off to do that. And so through that study, which was of 12 men at two universities in the Northeast, 12 college men that considered themselves active in their faith, I sat down three times with each of them, and I asked them questions around who they were as men, who they were as persons of faith, and how in which those identities conflicted, they intersected, they overlapped. And what I found was a deepened understanding of some of the frustrations that young men were having on around three particular areas. The first of which was around family and community. The second of which is around careers, callings, vocations. And the third of which around sex and sexuality. I recognized that many men struggled with this desire to become a father and felt that the ways in which they were living currently were often incongruent with the father that they wanted to become. And many of them struggled, in particular in this liminal space of college, when they were trying to find who they were and who they were becoming as men, of figuring out what type of future father they were becoming, because they very much desired to be in community and to be a good brother and sister. And I think they struggled broadly with being congruent in those experiences. The second of which, around careers, callings, and vocations, a great example is, how am I going to become, you know, a doctor and an MD and make all this money? Is that inherently flawed? Is that inherently wrong? Should I be, for example, a student at a high research activity university said, should I be padding my resume for med school, or should I be serving in the community? And so these conflicts and questions that started to come up were very much challenging, because there were no clear answers. And if they went to their pastor, they might be told one answer. And if they went to their med school admissions officer, they might be told another. And there was no one really that could overlap that direction. I would say the most interesting aspect of the dissertation was a conversation around sexuality, which was filled with many frustration, anger, guilt, doubt. Many of the students struggled with wanting to, you know, save themselves for marriage. They struggled with engaging in the hookup culture, becoming men who they weren't through that process, and they didn't feel that they were called to be. And then also to go there, you know, really were challenged around questions of masturbation and pornography and how that was reconciled with their faith in the man that they were becoming. Many of them felt frustration and guilt around that, but felt they were in a bit of a vicious cycle, I called it, because they would make a mistake, they would feel guilty and see that something within their faith was calling them to do something different, but they wouldn't have people that they could talk to or outlets. They didn't have accountability partners that would support them. And then they slip deeper into darkness and would continue down a spiraling path. And so, again, that not only was interesting from a research side, but it's engaged me on a personal level, in a sense, to think about the ways in which boys and men today are formed, ways in which they might experience questions about who they are, ways in which they experience doubt, particularly now at a Catholic school, ways in which we're trying to form students in virtue, but then asking boys around, again, what type of men are they becoming, and how is that congruent with them as men of faith? Those are very challenging questions, and those are ones that can be introduced early on. And I also think the formation of the students goes hands in hands with the conversation with fathers, with mothers, around raising boys. And so really critically thinking about how we're serving boys and girls, both not only as themselves and as children of God, but also as gendered beings and people that are formed in a particular way and don't exist in a vacuum, ones that are embedded in culture and cultural expectations. You know, for example, men are socialized to engage in hypermasculine norms. So, you know, this independent stoicism, this need to work hard, to do it on my own, to pull myself up by my bootstraps, very much an American ideal. Those things in themselves aren't inherently wrong, but if not engaged in a social structure and engaged around critical questions around faith, can leave men with a type of inadequacy, with not the tools that they need to prepare to engage in the world and engage and influence accordingly. And so part of the questions that I continue to ask is, how can we better serve the students, the next generation of leaders, you know, around this particular question? And then how in particular can we engage boys and men around these particular questions that lead to deeper reflection, that lead to deeper perspective taking, and that lead to a sense of wholeness of self and one that is rooted in the image and likeness of God?
A couple things to dig into there. So one thing I noticed is that with football, it was who you were. And when I say who you were, it was how society interacted with you. And it was also what you did. And ultimately, as you went through that transition phase, you ended up at a place where who you were also became what you did. Is that the ideal, where who you are is what you do? Or was there a time where you saw yourself separating your faith and that identity from your professional career? Because obviously, if you were headed to the NFL, that's football, and that's, again, who you are and what you do. And so what are your thoughts on that piece for you?
Yeah, I would say broadly that there were times, I mean, that was my own discernment as an undergraduate student at Boston College when I was in a finance major and I decided to go into the field of marketing. I also picked up a studio art minor, which many people don't know about me as well.
Could you have been happy with those? Or do you feel like you needed to have who you are be what you do?
I felt very much the need to, I mean, this goes along with all we're talking about, all I've been reflecting on around vocational discernment. I wanted who I was to be reflected in what I do and who I'm called to be. That didn't mean that I couldn't work in this field of finance, but it wasn't deeply what I felt called to, and I wasn't, frankly, that good at it. And I didn't want to be stuck in something that I didn't feel called to be there, even though I very much enjoy the finance world. That was also what my dad told me as a child, that would make money. Mm-hmm. So my sense is that people need to be asking questions around who they are and who they're becoming and who they're called to be, and not necessarily follow the formulas. Not the formulas in themselves inherently are wrong, but if someone tells me that I need to do X, Y, and Z, I need to try that hat on myself. I need to ask those questions. I need to put myself in the space and ultimately pray and discern about that in order to find the right congruency with who I am and who I'm becoming. And I would say in a particular way, as a man, it feels very much that who men are defined as what they do and what they achieve. And one of the things that has transformed that for me has been my faith life. Don't get me wrong, I still care about who I am, what I do, and what I achieve. And that's something, you know, we all have to reconcile around ego and humility. But one of the things that I thought was so remarkable in these early days when I was considering my faith was that it, really the notion that God loves me deeply right where I'm at in my journey. Not for what I do, but for just because I'm made in that God's image and likeness, so that God loves me on all my weaknesses and all my brokenness and all my sin. And God loves me despite of that, and doesn't love me for, you know, how much I make, what prestige I achieve. And so for me, that framework has been freeing, and been freeing in such a way that I said, you know what, I played football, but, you know, I've been called by name, by God, by a particular reason. And in that sense, I do the work and I achieve not because I care about the vanity or the ego, but that I see this as a pursuit of not only who I'm called to be, but also doing God's work in this world and being very intentional about that. Those are things that I could not have achieved, or a thinking that I not could have had, not only if I didn't have something that stopped me right in the tracks as a young person, but then also some of the formation that I received during those times that really flipped upside down who I was and who I was becoming, and took me away from this, you know, very masculine-driven, achievement-driven, label-driven. Again, not that those things are inherently bad in and of themselves, but that they created disorder in me that wasn't right, and that wasn't rightly ordered. And so again, my faith has been something that's consistently grounded me and consistently caused me to ask questions. So it's always great for me to reflect consistently on, you know, the most difficult parts of my life and the biggest achievements to say, where was God in that? How do I continue to grow and gain perspective on that? Because I look at it differently over time.
You still have found yourself as an archetype because, you know, people led with football and now they're going to lead with religion. Mm-hmm. And I guess the difference is that because you chose it and it wasn't thrust upon you, that you're more at peace with that. You know, obviously it has some of the same trappings because people are going to want to talk religion with you, or if not religion, maybe religious education first and foremost. And because of your position, which isn't, you know, a higher position, and your athletic position was a higher position. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of the same process, right?
Absolutely. And I think one of the greatest things that I learned that was actually freeing is that I actually feel like I resist on a personal level is being put into a particular box. You know, I think when I lost, my athletic identity was challenged and shattered. One of the things that, you know, I sought out to do was I went in, you know, again, back in the achievement, but playing into that in different ways. I went and I ran the Boston Marathon. Mm-hmm. Who would have thought that a 292-pound defensive lineman who was on the field 2 years earlier would go and achieve in this certain way? You know, my challenge for myself is to consistently always be asking questions around who I am and who I'm becoming and refining that, because I think we're all continuing to ask that throughout our lives. And I think as I consider myself a learner, the moment that I can consider myself fully set in stone as a religious educator or a Catholic educator, that's when I think we can get caught in particular archetypes. Again, not that the archetypes are bad in themselves, but my sense is that it's a lifelong journey to ask these questions and to consistently discern and reflect, because who knows what 5, 10, 15 years, how that might change over time, how might that lead me to other ways of knowing and other ways of discerning. For me right now, it's where I feel particularly called, but that could change any day, any time. And so I think the lesson for me is that I always need to be open to where God is calling me and to not entrench myself so much within identities and labels and things that can sometimes keep us from being that reflective, that learner, that perspective taker, that consistently ask questions. And so as a learner and as someone who values lifetime learning, I feel like I'm always learning about myself. I'm always learning about others. I'm always in relationship. And so the contexts themselves, they'll change, but I want to be challenged. I want to be asked those questions because ultimately it'll continue to refine my understanding of God's purpose for me. And then also will continue to challenge me to spend more time in prayer, discerning and asking questions.
Another thing I'm really curious about, when you look at social constructs, you know, you mentioned that, you know, you worked with guys that were, I'm assuming some of them at least had religious inclination. And so they were struggling with some of the things you talked about. And when you look at, you know, what keeps someone from robbing a bank, it's because there's the police that are there and you could go to jail. There's a source for the authority. In this situation, people have, you know, these groups of guys clearly have the same concerns or at least similar concerns. What is that force that just keeps them from being comfortable talking about it? There is no police of, you know.
Well, you know, and I love that you use the word police because that's one of the things we talked about quite a bit in terms of gender policing that broadly goes on from men and women in today's day and age, and that boys and girls are consistently socialized into. I always joke that, you know, when my brother, when he had a boy, what are they getting him? The trucks, the loud stuff, the big items. And what are they getting my niece? The dolls and the doll houses and the Barbies. And my sense is before we're even born, we're socialized into a certain way of thinking and being, and that men are policed into and are shamed or ridiculed or doubted in different situations, particularly in hypermasculine environments. Two examples being in sports, maybe in military as well, where there's a general expectation that people need to act in line in accordance to the normative way of thinking. And the normative way of thinking is generally, when it's left to be a de facto, it's generally around independence, stoicism. And so to ask for help as men, and I see it even in boys that I work with currently, is seen as a weakness and is seen as something that if the larger community knew about, it would be questioned. And it is questioned, which is part of why I think a lot of my work is also very much individualized strategically, that it's just like I did the other day. It's pulling a young boy aside and saying, let's take a walk. Let's have a conversation in a space where he's not going to feel shamed by his particular peers. And that it's not like I called him out in front of his larger community, but I just said, let's take a walk. And I take a walk and I get to know that student as a human being and as a person. You know, and then I ask questions about who he is and who he's becoming. And ultimately, it becomes much more of a formational conversation. But I think the difficulty for men is having the courage to step outside of oneself when that policing is happening. And I would say on a hierarchical level, there's always a social hierarchy going on with men. If you think about men that are at the top of the totem pole. So the man that is always being the loudest, that is always ridiculing the other, that might have also unearned masculine capital, I would call it, such as what I had at different points in life, being a big guy, playing football. There's certain validation structures that come out of that that are inherent that people aren't even recognizing or understanding. And so the goal is, as men, and why we see a bunch of men who are in a circle negging each other, is because they want to move to the top of that social hierarchy. And you know why? They don't necessarily need or want to move to the top, but they want to make sure that they are not on the bottom of the totem pole, that they are not the one that's being ridiculed, shamed, doubted. And so generally, as the research proves, men, when they're in those positions, they generally act out. And they act out sometimes aggressively. They act out in ways that compensates for their lack of masculinity. And they act out in a way that is counterproductive to who they are and who they want to be, but they feel policed in an environment and they feel the only way to move out of it is to succumb to that environment. So that's when you see many boys who are struggling with, you know, bullying or acting out of character. My sense is that they're trying to prove something and they're trying to prove a type of belonging and a normative way of masculinity. And so we all laugh about things like the Napoleon complex, but those things operate very much in a real way on an everyday level with boys. And then if you choose not to socialize in those environments, and I would call those very typical locker room environments and locker room culture. If you choose not to socialize in them, those generally, you may be outcasted outright. And so I think the challenge is really to, you know, help boys to understand what's going on, how in which they might not be acting in accordance to ways they were informed and raised, and to interrupt that. You know, one of the things, again, that we've introduced at the school is the morning convocation program. And it's meant to form students in particular around particular virtues, humility, compassion, fortitude, authenticity, and wisdom. So imagine a man going up there and maybe a more senior student going up there and sharing about themselves and about their faith or ways in which compassion has formed the behavior that they've had. Imagine then also students in that room seeing older men, men in the community, men in positions of prominence, and men in leadership who have perceived to have made it and done it all, to be then modeling a type of authenticity that isn't normative within the social culture. Those are the things that I think we can be really strategic about interrupting, and also can at least build the capacity for boys and men to ask questions about that. And I think that, again, is a lifelong journey. But I think forming students and forming young boys in ways in which they can ask questions critically of themselves, reflect about ways in which they've been socialized, and then ultimately come to a more authentic version of themselves through reflection and perspective taking is ultimately, I think, the formula combined with, you know, great mentoring and great people in the community.
And what you're doing there is you're building new hierarchies. You're putting new aspirationals out there as people who are authentic and share, and putting that out in the public sphere so that people see it and look up to it. And it just restructures the ladder to some extent.
Yeah. And my sense is that, and hierarchy, I think, for a lot of different reasons, gets a bad association tied to it often. But my sense is that in the formative ages of high school in particular, you know, high school students, they want structure. They are trying so desperately to figure out who they are and who they're becoming. And we aren't giving any guide maps. And there's lack of a guidepost. And so I think when parents are investing a place to send their children, we need to create particular guideposts that allow them to start rethinking that, or else, frankly, we're not doing our jobs. And my sense is that same thing that happens in college when parents are investing in a particular partnership with that university, that they're reflecting the values they might aspire to in the home, but also are ultimately causing individuals and young people to ask questions. I remember actually, just as an aside, many freshman parents who were calling the school at Boston College when I was there saying, why is Johnny questioning me all the time? Why is Johnny not just falling in line in what he's always done? And so I think as parents too, I think the struggle is allowing also young people and children to really think about themselves critically and not in the image and likeness of the parents. And I think that's one of the challenges that I think, particularly in a college or university environment, I saw multiple times, because it was really challenging for parents to let go of what their image of who that person was becoming. But education is meant to be formational. It's meant to be, and particularly a liberal arts education by which I was formed in, and now in Catholic education at a high school, it's meant to ask questions, questions of ourselves, who we are, how we fit in the world, and who we've been called to be. And so those questions are part of that process of growing up. And if we dissolve the ability for people to be able to ask, who am I? Who am I becoming? And have a freedom within that, which that freedom itself, even of itself, is a privilege to even be able to ask that. Because many people don't have an ability to even ask that. They say, you know what, I need to work a particular job and I need to take care of my family. Mm-hmm. And I need to do that at 14, 15, 17, 18. And I need to gain full employment as my role. Just want to note that. That we're also talking in the sense of sort of privileges that we have. And given the ability to invest in ourselves and in education, the responsibility I think we have as educators is to consistently form young people around asking questions, not only of themselves, of materials, and be able to critically think about, again, who they are and how they're going to fit in this world, particularly an increasingly complex world, socially, professionally, politically. If we aren't equipping young people with the tools to be able to ask questions, to engage in dialogue civilly and to be thoughtful in their thinking, then we're doing all of them a disservice. And so that's one of the things, again, I wake up every morning thinking about is how to best serve our young people in a world that is changing so rapidly, in a world that we won't know what it's going to look like 20 years from now. But I do know that if we aren't forming them in such a way that they can critically think about it, then the formulas that they followed are going to expire and they're not going to be relevant.
That's a great observation.
And so we need to, in some ways, create a crossroads for them. And it doesn't always have to be a big injury, right?
Right.
It doesn't always have to be one particular thing. It can be small instances that stop people in their tracks and get them to think about who they are and who they're becoming. And those crossroads really get them thinking in a way of one of the formulas in student development is self-authorship. So really going from following formulas to crossroads to then self-authoring my experience. Many spend their lives in formulas, and many have struggled in allowing themselves to truly go through the crossroads stage, even if, I mean, I could have had my injury and just said, you know what, I'm going to keep plugging through and I'm going to go and I'm going to be a finance major. I'm going to go on Wall Street. And I may not ever question that throughout my life. Would that have been good for my heart and soul? Would it probably have bubbled up some other way later in life? Probably. But by allowing myself in that moment to question and say, you know what, I don't know who I am, and just owning that allowed me to at least be in a place of openness where I could engage in sort of that crossroads and that period of uncertainty. And funny enough, I'm bringing back a prayer I shared earlier around trust in the slow work of God and being gentle and patient with myself. That uncertainty is where it all happens. It's in those liminal spaces where we don't know. And having a healthy balance, again, another developmental theory that talks about a healthy balance of challenge and support. You know, I don't need to have exceptionally high challenge and zero support, because that will certainly not be a good environment for me, to not be a developmentally appropriate environment. And I also don't want too much support to where I'm just cradled.
Which is very common nowadays.
Very common. And to where I have zero challenge. So how do we find an optimal balance to really build optimal development for young people?
It's wonderful. I appreciate you sharing your story and your insight. I'm going to finish with bringing us back to the police and putting you on a St. Pete arrest, which is a variation of house arrest. We're going to get you one of those ankle bracelets and you're not allowed to leave St. Pete because we definitely need more thinkers and educators that are digging in as deep as you are, and very appreciative that you're in the community. And I hope you will meld with as many other educational leaders as you can. And I know good things will come out of that.
Well, thank you. And I thank you for providing the space that asks those particular questions and allows people to have forums where they can engage that. Because I think with that, we can grow together and more stronger as a community.